Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast on this Easter weekend. Boy, this is there's a lot to catch up on today, and we are joined by The Atlantic's David Frum. David, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it very, very much.
What a pleasure to be here.
Well, you know, I'm always guilty talking with you because you saw so much that was going on the right years before I did, and so I'm always a little bit chagrined, you know, why it took me so long to see what you saw about a decade earlier than I did. So kudos to you, but a little bit of chagrin on my part.
Well, you are not here in Washington, and that gave you your vantage point, which was important. It's like those, you know, remember when you were reading history as a boy, they would always tell you the provinces flourished under the Emperor Nero. And they said, well, they were farther away.
I'm definitely going for that. So, okay, so there's a lot of things that we need to talk about, substantive things, major issues that will shape the economy and society, the debate about the vaccine passports, the border crisis, which is actually a crisis, the massive infrastructure plan. But of course, we have to talk about Matt Gaetz and the unraveling of Matt Gaetz. This thing is escalating at incredible speed, and in part it's because everybody knew about Matt Gaetz and everybody hates Matt Gaetz. And so it's sort of like, well, yeah, haven't you been paying attention? This guy is one of the skeeziest people in American politics. What a shock. So your thoughts on the meltdown of Matt Gaetz and the drumbeat of stories that are coming out almost, it feels like hour by hour now.
Yeah, well I think what happened in the Trump years was a lot of skeezy people were attracted to Trump, not because they necessarily cared that much about Trump, but because they recognized in him someone who could protect them, someone who didn't care, someone who maybe didn't have even some of the self-protection that normal politicians would have to stay away from skeezy people. And there was also a kind of moral holiday in the Trump Hotel. That was the place you could go, and all kinds of things would happen that wouldn't normally happen. And Matt Gaetz was obviously part of that he sensed Trump would protect him, and he was attracted by Trump's "who cares" attitude toward basics.
And he was quite explicit about all of this. And I was rereading the Vanity Fair profile, which also then talks about his own book, and where Gaetz credits Trump with making life easier in Washington for a guy like him. You know, yeah. And he described himself as, "I arrived in D.C. as a single man after a couple of long-term relationships that didn't work out, and a thrice-married serial adulterer as the face of the Republican Party certainly provides some cover for members who might step outside the lines." This is what he said. "We've got a president now who doesn't care for puritanical grandstanding or moralistic preening. He's a lot more direct, more visceral, open, blah, 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 blah. I have an active social life, and it's probably easier in the era of Trump. We've had perfect family man presidents before, after all, and many of those men sold out our country, even if their wives were happy the whole time. If politicians' family lives aren't what really matters to voters, maybe that's a good thing. I'm a representative, not a monk." No kidding.
Okay, that's news to me. That's incredible.
It is.
Kudos to the ghostwriter who got Matt Gaetz to sign it. I wonder if he read it before he did. I'm reminded of something I heard in 2016. I had somebody who'd once worked for me, a very bright young guy who'd become very caught up in the Trump movement. And he was an unlikely person to get caught up in the Trump movement. And I was talking to him, why does this appeal to you? And he said, "Trump is our first post-religious president. And we've had less religious presidents before, but they usually pretended to be more religious than they were." And Barack Obama pretended to be more religious than he was. But Trump just said, he just made it obvious, I don't care about any of this. And for a certain kind of person in the Republican world, that was liberating. I don't know if American politics goes back to it. I don't know if Republican politics goes back to it.
You know, again, as I mentioned before, a lot of this stuff has been known. I'm reading the ABC report this morning about sources said that Gaetz was part of a group of young male lawmakers back in Florida who created a game to score their female sexual conquests, which granted points for various targets, such as intern staffers or other colleagues. And now, of course, we're finding out that, you know, he was part of this deal where they recruited women online for sex, received cash payments. Okay, so I want to put this in the context because I think you're absolutely right that if Donald Trump was the ultimate get out of, you know, get out of jail free card for a lot of these politicians to change the definition of, you know, scandal, certainly career ending scandal. Yeah. But where does this fit in the culture wars? The GOP is totally invested in the culture wars. And as you and I are speaking right now, it is not absolutely certain that Matt Gaetz will not politically survive this. That no. Trump world, I mean, it's certainly possible the Trump world will throw him under the bus. There's no loyalty, et cetera. But it's also certainly possible that this will be, you know, a repeat of the story we've seen before, where people say, well, he's attacked by the mainstream media, the deep state, et cetera. Let's rally around him. I mean, it's possible that Matt Gaetz comes out of this. He's got a big contract at Newsmax, is the guy that pushed back. So where does this fit in the context of the Republican Party's total investment in the culture war? If a guy like Matt Gaetz is one of the faces of the party.
It means that the culture war has changed from a fight about sexual behavior to a fight about sexual roles. And it's changed from a fight about the place of Christianity to a fight about the place of the white race. The United States just generally has become a much more secular society in the 21st century. Back in the 1990s, what we all used to remark was that one of the things that made America exceptional was here was a highly developed country that remained, at least if you looked at the surveys, a highly religious country. Now, Americans didn't behave as religiously in the 1990s, as they said, when you actually check church attendance, they didn't go to church as much as they said they did. But if you ask them, do you believe in God? Do you believe in an afterlife? Do you believe in Orthodox Christian religion? You would get 80-90% who said they did. Since the year 2000, we have just seen a plummet in both what people say about their practice. We have seen a plummet in people claim to be church members. And Republicans are touched by that too. We are secularizing incredibly quickly. And in fact, since over the past 20 years, we have moved at a pace that is putting us online to catch up with to where Western Europe is. And we will catch up to them fairly soon. And so, you know, we've seen this with all your favorite Fox News personalities. Roger Ailes, Bill O'Reilly, they were not observing any of the sexual norms that they championed against Bill Clinton. I mean, to the contrary, they were sexual predators and lost their jobs because of it. And as you well know, there are many other people who just stepped aside in time who participated in that same culture that existed at Fox. So what we're seeing is an evolution from religion to race as the organizing principle of conservative American politics.
Well, that's hard to disagree with. I guess the dilemma is watching the performative Christianity being ratcheted up at the same time that, in fact, they are actually secularizing the culture and are part of that. And that's the part I think that makes your head hurt. I mean, there's just a certain element of pure hypocrisy here, but I think you're right is the way this has shifted. Speaking of the way the culture has shifted and the Republican Party has lost its mind, I, of course, haven't read it yet, but former Speaker John Boehner is out with a book, a tell-all book that, at least based on the Politico excerpt, does not disappoint. And he talks about the crazies. And he talks about, you know, sitting down with Roger Ailes and his crazy conspiracy theories. And he said, I thought I could get him to control the crazies. And instead, I found myself talking to the president of the club. And then he describes how the Republican Party and the right became crazy town. And that even though he's the Speaker of the House of Representatives, he didn't hold all the power because the power had gone to the crazies in Fox News, the Hannitys, the Mark Levins of the world, and the way in which this just changed all of the incentive structure for the Republican Party.
Yeah. Well, they were Fox News, the senior people there became dealers who actually used their own product, which is never a good idea. What you kind of hope – and is that Rupert Murdoch and Roger Ailes and maybe two, you know, of the brighter stars, not Sean Hannity, obviously, but are, you know, they're reading the financial – they may say this stuff on the air, but they're reading the Financial Times. They know that gravity is true. They know how many planets there are. They're not completely detached from reality. But the problem is that the kind of thing that Fox does, you can't really do it unless you participate in the belief to some degree. And doing it also changes you. So, you know, my old friend Tucker Carlson, who I believe started as a total cynic and would have said the exact opposite if told to by Lachlan Murdoch. I think at this point he believes a lot of what he says. And many of the other Fox personalities, I think, do authentically believe it. And some, like Hannity, are too dim to sort out what they believe from what they don't believe. But it is a self-destroying environment. One thing about John Boehner, I read the political excerpt. I have not seen the book. And in the world of talk radio and talk media, Boehner wrote something a little carelessly that is going to get him into trouble. But I want to defend what he meant. He writes, Mark Levin was the first to go on the radio and spout off this crazy nonsense. And people – and the paragraph above it where he's describing – mixes up the accusations that Obama was a Muslim and Obama was a communist and Obama hates America with the birther stuff.
Yeah.
And so people are defending Mark Levin right now, saying Levin was not a birther. And he wasn't exact. He was sort of a birther, but sort of not. Like, he didn't believe that Obama was born in Kenya, but he believed that because Obama's father was, that made Obama ineligible to be president. But Levin was absolutely first out of the gate with the Obama is a Marxist. And Levin was the first to say that Obama was waging war on America. And Levin actually tweeted his unhappiness that he never got credit for being the first to say that Obama was waging war on America. But because of the rather messy way Boehner wrote his memoir, that it's the Levin and his friends are pushing back in a way that is literally true but largely deceptive.
Yeah, that paragraph, he says Mark Levin was the first to go on the radio and spout off this crazy nonsense. And then he goes on to say, it got him ratings, so eventually he dragged Hannity and Rush to Looneyville along with him. My longtime friend Roger Ailes, the head of Fox News, was not immune to this. He got swept into the conspiracies and the paranoia and became an almost unrecognizable figure. And I think you and I remember this weird vortex watching one figure after another be sucked in and go to Looney Town or Crazy Town. But of course, this had happened before 2010. This had happened before 2011. And I guess this goes back to the dilemma that we all are facing is like, okay, so how far back did this go and why didn't we see it? And I think that we could spend a lot of time on that. By the way, you mentioned Fox News. Since we're on the issue of Fox News and on the issue of Tucker Carlson and whether he believes the stuff he says, I want to play for you a short excerpt from his show last night. Your publication, The Atlantic, has a deep dive into the wrongest man on the pandemic, this guy, Alex Berenson, who has been wrong over and over and over again about the coronavirus. I mean, it is a record rather kind of breathtaking in its consistent wrongitude. And yet, despite the fact that he has been, you know, mendacious and inaccurate and misleading, he continues to get airtime on Fox. And despite all the documentation, he was on Fox last night and he wasn't on Hannity's show. He's on Tucker Carlson's show. And again, the reason I'm emphasizing that is because Tucker theoretically should know better. But this is what Tucker Carlson had to say about, again, you know, the Atlantic, it's a very widely read story, a very respected publication. It's your publication, David. But this is what Tucker Carlson had to say last night.
So it shouldn't surprise you that the Atlantic magazine, one of the most craven, corrupted pieces of garbage in journalism, has a new cover story out this week. In fact, I believe today, attacking Alex Berenson because he read from a different script. And that can't be allowed. The piece is called The Pandemic's Wrongest Man. We know Alex Berenson pretty well after a year of talking to him, so we invited him into the studio tonight. He is, of course, the author of Unreported Truths About COVID-19 and Lockdowns, Part 4 Vaccines. He joins us on our set tonight to respond to this predictable, and I don't even know if it's annoying it's so dumb, but assess.
Okay, so David yeah. Frum, Tucker Carlson is all in on this coronavirus conspiracy denialism now.
Well, let us first say the story in The Atlantic, which is written by my colleague Derek Thompson. Derek Thompson did not just opine. Derek Thompson is a business journalist. He's not an epidemiologist. What he did was he showed Alex Berenson's work to America's most distinguished scientists. And it was those distinguished scientists who described it as wrong or stupid. And so you're not arguing with the Atlantic. And one of the things that is the difference between the kind of journalism that is done at places like the Atlantic and the kind that is done at Fox is we don't let poets and novelists pronounce on epidemiology. We go to the epidemiologists, and then the poets and the novelists, you know, we write down what they say, and we present it to you in a way that's maybe more engaging than the scientists would say it themselves. But when we tell you this is what the scientists think, we actually have, you know, a dozen scientists who say it. But what happened to the conservative world over COVID, though, is really an amazing thing. This is a true might have been. There was no necessary reason that the conservative world should have gone full in on COVID denial. No. People remember Ebola. Remember when Obama, because Obama was in charge when Ebola broke out in West Africa, they went the other way. The conservatives went to extreme alarmism about Ebola.
Hair on fire. Yep.
Hair on fire. Mm-hmm. And had Hillary Clinton been president, I have no doubt that COVID would have been on Fox a giant scandal. And by the way, from a conservative point of view, since in advance of the vaccine, the most effective prophylactic against COVID is really cheap, a face mask. So you can do it with, you can fight COVID without a big budgetary commitment. It should have been very appealing to consider. So it was driven in the first place by Trump's ego needs and Trump's need to cover himself from his own failure and Trump's poor understanding of how a modern economy worked, that he somehow believed if he could somehow talk people into staying open, that the economy wouldn't crash in the face of the pandemic, even though it crashed. It wasn't the lockdowns that crushed the economy. It was the pandemic that made people stay, everyone who had disposable income stay home. But now this has become an important part of the conservative world. And what it's done is it's opened the door to some pretty wild things, including, I mean, I think Berenson's position is just generally skeptical of vaccinations of all kinds. Skeptical of medicine as it's practiced in the United States in all kinds of ways. And that door is now open and it's become an important part of the conservative mentality. It didn't have to be.
Yeah, you had a really, I thought, intriguing piece in The Atlantic about the debate about the vaccine passports, that suddenly the Republicans have decided that they really hate the idea of passports, that it's totalitarian. And you have the governor of Florida who's saying that he's going to issue an order or pass a law or whatever, or at least he's going to try to prohibit private businesses from requiring proof of vaccination, which, as you point out, is an interesting departure from what Republicans used to say about private property rights.
Yeah. Now, in some ways, I suspect this may turn out in the end to be a pretty theoretical discussion. Mm-hmm. Like, tuberculosis is a highly infectious disease, but you are not asked to present proof that you've been vaccinated against tuberculosis when you go to a baseball game, because everyone knows, virtually everybody in American society has had the vaccinations in childhood against these diseases. So, you know, the few people who for one reason or another missed it, they don't present a public health threat. It's not worth the trouble to check. And so that may well be the fate of COVID. We may have such a high rate of take-up of the vaccine, it may not be necessary to do anything more.
Right.
That's probably certainly so long as you're within the borders of the United States. But it may be that there's certain kinds of there's certain places where, at least for a time being, like a basketball game, you're in a confined space, you're very close, there's a lot of yelling. And you know, you can see why the Miami Heat, for example, has said that we're going to have special sections for people who can show they've been vaccinated, and they don't have to socially distance because we know they don't present a threat to each other. That's a private person doing this. I mean, so when people are attacking that, what they're saying is, I want to be able to come into your stadium and watch your NBA franchise and spread viruses, whether you like it or not, mm-hmm. on your property. And I go through a series of things where that the conservative demand has been, I want to do my thing, which is hazardous to others, on your property. And that's what I want to spread conspiracy theories on your Twitter. Thank you, Mr. Twitter, for inventing Twitter. It's a wonderful platform. It's free. There isn't even much advertising on it, unlike Facebook. So now that you've built this, it's like an Ayn Rand story in reverse. So it is with a lot of the gun debate, which is where this started. It started in the early 2000s with a demand that is now the law in about half the states, that people be permitted to stow their guns in trunks in cars parked mm-hmm. in other people's parking lots.
Right. Telling the basically saying to private businesses, you can't have these rules, imposing them. And this is, you know, you and I were talking briefly before we began the podcast, but the trade-offs that conservatives have made, that some of these issues have been intention. So talk about that a little bit. The way in which the conservative, you know, the whole idea of what is a conservative. Well, it's choosing which things you value more, what you prioritize, and what you're willing to throw away.
Well, I think this is just generally true about the way systems of ideas work. They're assemblies. And whether you consider yourself liberal or conservative, you have a series of beliefs that are linked together, and there is always potential tension between them. Now, in more normal times and more relaxed times, the pressure isn't on your ideas, and so if there are tensions, they don't really flex in the way that they do. But what Trump did for conservatives was and one of the reasons you and I are here on this podcast instead of where we might have been a decade ago, is we discovered. Oftentimes, things we cared about became suddenly intention. And I mean, the one we were talking about before the show was, I think you and I would have said in 2005, we believe in free trade and low taxes.
Right.
So, okay, what if a politician came along who said, you have to choose that he's offering low taxes, but protectionism? And, well, we haven't seen that since really the Great Depression, that choice. But my reaction is, well, if I have to choose, I would rather have free trade and higher taxes than protectionism and lower taxes. I'd rather not choose. I'd rather have both together. But if I have to choose. And in a series of other ways that Trump forced us and the Trump era has forced a series of choices. Generally, I'm a favorite. People should make their own personal intimate decisions on their own. And had I been asked 10 years ago, what do you think about parents who – people who refuse to be vaccinated, your children, it's a different matter. People who refuse vaccinations, well, so long as it's marginal, so long as it's few, so long as they live in rural areas, I don't see that there's a lot of purpose to the state trying to apply pressure to get us from 97% vaccination to 100%. Okay, now it's a culture war thing, and they insist on I want to march into your Trader Joe's. Unvaccinated and without a mask, and expose all of Trader Joe's customers and employees, whether Trader Joe's, Mr. Trader Joe, likes it or not. Wait a minute, Mr. Trader Joe owns that store. I remain committed to property rights, and I'm more committed to property rights in this crazy new vaccine culture war. Mr. Trader Joe gets to say how things are done in his store, and if he wants to protect his, and if he intelligently wants to protect his customers and employees through science. And you say, no, I've got this magic amulet. I don't need science. Sorry. Go to the magic amulet store. Shop for your cashews there.
You know, it's interesting. I was reading last night. We have a great piece up on the Bulwark right now by Joshua Tate about a pretty much forgotten chapter in American conservative history. It's called the New Conservatives. This was a group of people post-war who were trying to redefine conservatism in a very centrist sort of way. It really parallels a lot of the debates that we're having now about center left and center right and whether or not you can have a conservatism that rejects the extremes of the right. And people like Clinton Rossiter were leading exponents of that completely. Yes, and completely forgotten now on the right. I mean, really, yeah. To say that they lost and were exiled is putting it mildly. But one of the things I was reading is I was actually – I'm sorry, this sounds like a digression, but I actually found a 1956 television discussion, early public television from Syracuse University, where these guys are sitting around talking about the future of conservatism in 1956. And it's fascinating. It's really, it is almost word for word the discussions we have now. But the reason I'm bringing this up is because there was a real consensus among these new conservatives that in fact, rejecting this atomized individual notion that we have no responsibilities to one another and that conservatism would have, recognized patriotic obligation, your obligation, your responsibility to the community and to others. So this whole, I don't want to wear the mask, I want to do what I want to do mentality could not be more alien from what used to be the conservative sensibility.
Yeah. Well, those people in the 1950s, and as you say, Clinton Rossiter, Peter Viereck, and some others, they were reacting to the horrors of World War II, the horrors of Nazism. Peter Viereck had an especially interesting family history. His father was an illegitimate child of Kaiser Wilhelm II and immigrated to America and became the leading exponent for German nationalism inside the United States at a time when that, you know, the United States had a huge German-speaking minority. That was a lively concern. And the Germans were kicked around a lot during the First World War, ethnic Germans. And that led him when in the 1930s to think, okay, history is repeating itself. And once again, Germans are being unfairly targeted. Well, this time it's a little different. And so Peter Viereck reacted to his father's role as an exponent of – he got sucked into being a Nazi propagandist in the United States. I think he was arrested for it during the war. And they wanted to say, look, we need a politics that is anti-Nazi and anti-communist gets us out of some of this crazy regulation left over from the New Deal where, you know, it's illegal for a citizen to own a gold bar and where, you know, you want to ship a crate of lettuce across the country, you have to file a route map with a federal agency. You know, business people should be allowed to do business the way they in a freer way. But we reject all these radical and extremist totalitarian ideas. And you can see where that came from. And then Barry Goldwater discovered the real power of conservatism in America in the 60s is going to be opposition to the civil rights movement. Not that Barry Goldwater was in any way personally a racist. He absolutely was the opposite and had led the desegregation of his family's department stores in Phoenix, Arizona, and in every way had shown himself an open-minded man. But his ideology led him in a way that turned out to be much more politically lucrative than what Rossiter and Viereck was talking about in the 50s.
Yeah, and that was the turn. I want to talk about the border in a moment with you because you have a very provocative take on all of this. But just for a moment, can we talk about what's going on in Georgia with the voting? Because and of course this is happening all over the country. You have Republican legislators who have decided that they do not want to make it easier to vote. And you want to talk about the animating issue of the Republican Party right now, the culture war. I don't know anything that seems to express the id of Republicans right now more than making it harder for people to vote. Now, some of the rhetoric, I think, is overheated in Georgia, and some of the things that Joe Biden has said are inaccurate. He's been fact-checked by the Washington Post about some of the things he has said. But I have to tell you that David Perdue, defeated senator, was on with Bret Baier on Fox News last night. And this is a little bit long, unfortunately, this soundbite. But here's the guy, was at one time a mainstream Republican senator. And Bret Baier asked him the direct question, did you really lose this election? Did Donald Trump lose this? And as you listen to this, just realize that David Perdue, is refusing to acknowledge that he was in fact legitimately defeated and refusing to acknowledge that Donald Trump lost the state of Georgia even now. So let's play this. Bret Baier asking, I think a very direct, legitimate question of former Senator David Perdue.
You know, obviously the Secretary of State down there did an audit of the election. Election officials looked at it, did not find major irregularities or fraud that would change the election. Can you say today that John Ossoff was elected, duly elected, and beat you in the runoff, and that President Trump lost to Joe Biden?
Well, but here are the facts. There are data points that are never talked about in the liberal press, and one of these is that absentee ballots, which is what Stacey Abrams has been focused on for the last 3 years, went from 5% of the election to almost 30%. And in DeKalb County, as one example, only 9 absentee ballots were rejected because of faulty signature out of 136,000. It was similar in 9 other Democrat counties, and the probability of that happening, Brett, is 1 in 10,000. That's why I wanted a special session back in November. We wanted the Secretary of State to do an investigation. To my knowledge, that's never been done. The recount and all the other investigations were on other things and not on the signature veracity.
So you really can't say that tonight?
You know, what I can say this is this bill makes it a lot better in terms of the integrity of future people who are going to vote in the state of Georgia. That is a fact. It also gives.
So, David Frum, my take on that was, okay, so he draws the line from believing the big lie about the elections to this bill that was passed. And this, to me, is the sort of the original sin, that this legislation in Georgia was designed to address a problem that really arose from Donald Trump's lying about the election.
Yeah. Let me take a widen the aperture here a little bit, because I think one of the things that drives conservative politics, especially in the past 10 years, has been the sense of doom. And do you remember Paul Ryan's tipping point speech that was delivered in 2011 that we are approaching the moment where if this thing happens, and in that case it was passing Obamacare, that's it. Freedom in America, dead. It's a tipping point and you can never get it back. And that feeling you can never get it back is a pervasive feeling in the conservative world. Meanwhile, outside the United States, we see that the single most successful vote-winning organization in the democratic world is the Conservative Party of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. And maybe the second most successful vote-winning organization in the democratic world is the Christian Democratic Party of Germany. Certainly the top five is the Liberal Party of Australia. And of course, in Australia, they're the right of center party. And you just go through it. And in all other democracies, Canada, where I'm from, is because of the linguistic and regional federal politics are not very ideological. They're mostly about each region scrambling for a piece of the pie. But at the provinces where politics is more ideological, in the biggest province is Ontario, Alberta, the oil province, British Columbia, conservative parties win over and over and over again. It's just not true that if you get to the tipping point and then you're over the edge and conservatives can never win. Conservatives are very competitive in systems where people vote at higher rates than in the United States. I just wish I could make American Republicans believe that about their fellow citizens. But it is true if you want to compete in that way, you have to be a different kind of political party than Republicans currently want to be. If Americans voted at the 70% rate that is prevalent through the rest of the democratic world, it's not true that Republicans would be finished. They just wouldn't be. And they should. And in fact, they would be more competitive than ever, but they would have different kinds of voters. I mean, I remember the man who's now the present premier of Alberta, a man named Jason Kenney, who was formerly in the Federal Conservative Party and who mastered their ethnic this guy who went and learned a lot of, functional Vietnamese. He had this whole – he would have maps about which micro-ethnic groups were more open to the conservative message. If you referred to Chinese Canadians, he'd just look at you like you were an amateur. That he said, well, wait a moment. You have to understand that Mandarin-speaking Chinese vote completely differently from Cantonese-speaking Chinese. And Fujianese, different thing again. The Cantonese are very reachable for us. The Mandarin speakers are rather harder. The Fujianese are somewhere in the middle. Vietnamese, depending on where in Vietnam they came from. And the point was that what it did, what was really healthy, was this: you converted dangerous racial politics into familiar ethnic politics. That everyone understands that different ethnic groups in America have historically voted in somewhat different ways, and we all get along together. And big city politicians know you start the morning at a Greek church breakfast, and you go to an Irish funeral, and then there's a bar mitzvah, and you do all of these things together, and they're all slightly different, but you can work with all of them. And I think that could be the future of the Republican Party once you get them to say, you know what, we are getting out of the business of trying to shape the electorate. We accept the electorate. Now we're going to go win with a message that can win.
Yeah, that seems to not be the approach that they're taking right now. The degree to which they've internalized this notion that the more people vote, the worse it is. I mean, it seems almost universal at the moment. Even though, look, a successful political party figures out a way to have a message that they can sell. By the way, you've mentioned race a couple of times here, and there's something that's sort of nagging at the back of my mind. I'd like to get your take on. You know, especially with all of the, and I'm going to get to the George Floyd case is where I'm going on all of this. Listening to reading a lot of the conservative media commentary on George Floyd is really cringeworthy, especially when you think about that other strain in the conservative movement, which is about pushing back against government abuse, government power. Remember a few years ago, it was the jackbooted thugs and the black helicopters, yeah. And we need to stand. Why do we have a Second Amendment so that we can resist an oppressive, tyrannical government? And yet when it comes to police violence against African Americans, it is like a completely different category. And I don't know how closely you've been following the trial. I dip in and out. I'm not there for every bit of the testimony. But it seems to me to be very compelling and overwhelming that here you had a man whose life was taken by police officers abusing their power. And yet it is as if whether you're looking at, you know, the conservative print media, conservative broadcast, there's a complete lack of sympathy for this and a lack of concern mm-hmm. about what it represents. And so is this what you're talking about when you say the culture war has shifted from sex to race? Because it seems like they see everything through that particular lens. And I think the rest of the country is looking at this going, man, this is a guy, a human being whose life was taken under horrible circumstance. And everybody, you know, reasonable person that was watching this or on the scene was going, what are you doing? Why is this happening? This is wrong. And yet conservatives are deeply, a lot of the right wing, and not everybody, a lot of the right wing media is invested in find a way to rationalize it, justify it.
Yeah. I have a couple of rules for staying sane in the internet age. And one of them is I can't say I've met this rule with perfect consistency, but I really try not to react to viral video. And I try also to be very careful about reacting to trials on the basis of the inevitably partial information that we get. So I don't want to take us strong views on any particular case because the camera always lies. That was the story of the Nixon in all kinds of ways, like the Nicholas Sandman case. So the camera lied.
Oh yeah, that's right.
And the camera always lies. By the way, dogs can't play Jenga.
That's true.
That's a lie too. That took 12 hours of video to make the dog play Jenga. That's not true.
That's so disappointing.
I know it's heartbreaking.
I'm sorry. Okay.
But adorable animal. Yep. Adorable animal tricks, almost always faked. I'm sorry to tell it. Mm-hmm. You're the one to tell it to. So I want to be careful. But here's what we can say. We've got 150 years of history of local police departments abusing black people, especially black men. And every black person in America feels this. And whatever exactly happened in any one particular case, that one particular case is occurring against a background where people know, okay, even if it turns out that George Floyd, as the right-wing media are arguing, was reacting entirely to the illegal drugs that were present in his body. And even if the police officer's actions played only the most minimal part in the tragic eventual case, the reason that episode ignited America is because there were thousands of other cases dating back to the earliest days of the country where local people with police power committed murder.
Yeah.
So I can't judge what exactly happened in this case, but I know why people react the way they do. And that's something that we need to take on board. Now, fortunately, police departments are becoming better and more professional. And that's also true. And that's the point the conservatives make. And the number of fatalities is declining and actually is much smaller than many people may imagine. So there is a big story here, but I think civic nationhood requires of us is to enter into each other's experiences and understanding. When you hear from people, we find this enormously upsetting. You say, why? And even whatever the facts of the particular case, whatever the jury decides in this particular case, with all of the information that they're allowed to see, we all need to be mindful of the larger history of America.
So let's talk about the border, where there's clearly a serious problem. The Biden administration has been reluctant to call it a crisis. The pictures are kind of horrific. You have made the very provocative argument, though, that if liberals insist that only fascists will enforce borders, then voters will hire fascists to do the job that liberals refuse to do. Are you concerned that's the scenario that's going to play out again?
I tweeted, I think, on the day after Joe Biden's inauguration that the border was going to be the greatest threat to his first year in office. And so many things were going right with the vaccination program and the economic recovery. They just needed to be wary about this. And I got a lot of blowback from that, but unfortunately that proved to be a sound prediction. Let's step back for the larger problem. The United States has become increasingly effective since about 2005 at policing truly illegal immigration. And that has to do with things like Real ID. That has to do with just the greater sophistication of computer systems. That the number of illegal immigrants probably peaked. President of the United States peaked just before the Great Recession, and still has not grown. But there's a backdoor. The people who might have tried to travel illegally in the past, or the families of the people who did travel illegally in the past, have used the asylum system, which is not illegal, as basically a duplicate immigration system. Mm-hmm. The United States in the 1950s and 60s entered into international conventions about the treatment of asylum seekers that are basically written with like the people fleeing with in mind the people fleeing the Hungarian Revolution. You know, finite number of people coming from a political event, persecuted either for something they can't control, their race, their religion, or for their exercise of their legal human rights, for organizing a trade union or something like that. Then American courts went to elaborate, well, what do these international conventions mean? And they created ever wider concepts of what when you could seek asylum. Beginning in the 21st century, that legal permission met the plummeting cost of international travel. It's where you can get from the Congo to the southern border of the United States at a price that someone with a little bit of farmland in the Congo can afford to pay. So we've developed this giant industry, and it's become especially strong since the Great Recession, that moves people from Central America, from now increasingly from West Africa, some from China. And the cost is, you know, $6,000 if you come from Central America, maybe $8,000, as much as $20,000 if you come from Africa or China. And there are people who will get you to the border and see you all the way through. And that's the world's poorest people cannot afford those prices. But people with a little bit of farmland or people with relatives in the United States who will stake them, they can. And that is bumping into an American legal system that thinks, right, the asylum seekers are going to be like the refugees from the Hungarian Revolution. And you're getting these huge crises at the border that that baffled us in 2014 and 2016 when we had flare-ups. Then fear of Trump and then COVID deterred asylum seekers from 2018, 2019, 2020. But now they're coming back, and the Biden people need to find an answer to this. And the answer begins with understanding asylum, the asylum law that the United States has written for itself, which goes far beyond where international treaties are, is inviting people to take a dangerous gamble with their $5,000, $6,000, $8,000, $20,000 in savings.
Do you think that the Biden administration, though, would be willing to do that, particularly after the Trump years? Because it seems that they are invested, understandably, in being anti-Trump. I mean, in the opposite, that they will undo everything that Trump did, and anything that sounds like a Trump policy is going to be rejected. I mean, understandably. So, do you think that they're going to do that, or are they going to, you know, continue to sit back and, you know, experience this crisis?
I imagine that in the end, they will do what the Obama people did, which is crack down. Because if you don't crack down, you get an ever escalating. I mean, there really is no practical limit to the number of people who would like to claim asylum in the United States. And since American law now allows you to say poverty, domestic abuse, get prevalence of gang violence, these are bases for applying for asylum. Well, that describes a lot of the earth. There are hundreds of millions of people who can set, who live in places that are poor, or where there's a lot of domestic violence that the police don't do anything about, or where there's a lot of gang violence that defeats the state. I mean, maybe billions of people live under those conditions. So, and the price of making this move, I mean, yes, it's risky. You have to have a lot of physical courage, and women are sexually abused, and boys can be beaten. But the dollar price is manageable by a great many people all over the world. Huh. So they are going to crack down eventually. And the question is, how much political heat do they take along the way? I think it's just maybe post-Trump, maybe this is the way American politics work. As I'm going to say this as someone who grew up in Canada, I think it's sometimes hard for Americans to take seriously the existence of the rest of the planet. And so that issues get seen through a very specifically American lens. The very fact that we talk about the asylum problem as the border.
Well, right.
There's a lot of world beyond the border. So you need to think about the planet when you're thinking about asylum. But Americans see the border. What are we going to do? And then they see it very much in terms of domestic political considerations, domestic identities. And that means that they can't see the problem that is gathering and that will continue to gather unless something is done.
Yeah, no, there's no question about it that is a threat. I mean, I was thinking about, you know, what this year is going to be like. I mean, obviously, there's tremendous upside potential for the Biden administration in terms of the economy and getting the pandemic under order. We had a jobs report today, which was very, very optimistic. So what could go wrong? Well, the border would be number one. Urban unrest would be, close number two if that were to happen. But I guess it's a little bit disturbing that they have been unwilling to engage more directly with this issue, kind of hoping that they can distract from it. But as you have pointed out, it is not going away. And we've seen over the last few years how powerful an issue that is and how it can and that it's a legitimate issue, but also it can be demagogue. David Frum, thank you so much for your generosity with your time today. I appreciate it very, very much.
So glad to be here. Thank you.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back on Monday after Easter Sunday, and we will do this all over again.